RCR is on a mission to revive honest media. It's a good mission. And now you can be an integral part of it by joining the RCR Foundation Members Club. Receive exclusive benefits only available to club members, including discounted merch, your own backstage pass to join the hosts for interactive behind-the-scenes discussions, and the popular daily curated news summary, RCR Bites, delivered to your email box every weekday morning, keeping you on the pulse of the news that matters in just a few minutes per day. To find out more, check out www.realitycheck.radio/members or click the FMC button on the bottom right of your RCR app.
This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio. The Fourth Estate is RCR's newest discussion panel, where our host and guest cast a critical eye over the New Zealand media. Today's host is Marie Buskey, with her guests David Harvey and Peter Williams. It's time for the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio. I'm your host for today, Marie Buskey, and joining me this morning is our perennial favourite, Peter Williams. Good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Marie. Nice to talk to you.
Good afternoon, I should say. This is what happens with lunchtime, isn't it? And David Harvey, how are you, David? I feel like we've got the band back together.
I'm fine, thanks, Marie. All well here. Lovely to see you both again.
Yeah, it is so good to see you. And I can now officially call this meeting of AFS returnees open. I sort of feel like we've got a club coming on. Hey, look, it is good to have you back again this week, gents. There's been some interesting things that have cropped up in the media since we last caught up. And I want to first start up with, we'll kick it off with a retraction from our friends over at Stuff. And Peter, how the mighty Stuff has fallen. Was this a case, do you believe, of they were kind of hoping to get away with something and slip it past the goalie, but it didn't quite work out?
Yeah, the problem with journalism and documentary making is that sometimes, Marie, facts are facts. Now, I know that's a mantra that Stuff doesn't always play by, but on this occasion, the woman concerned did have an employment situation which she had outlined well in advance of the interview to the Fire and Fury people, and they frankly got it wrong. So I don't think Stuff had a leg to stand on here. So good for them for retracting it, albeit in a pretty low-profile way, because after all, that's what media organisations do when they have to apologise. They do it in the least visible way, but at least they have done it. But gee, it's only scratching the surface of all the things that were wrong with Fire and Fury, isn't it? Mm. So let's not go into a discussion on that. We've had plenty of those before. And let's just say the whole episode is a pretty sad chapter in the New Zealand media history. And this retraction is just a little postscript to it.
Yeah. So just for context for people, if you haven't caught up, former AUT academic Amy Baker Benjamin, she had already left AUT, I think, had a resignation. However, it was implied in the, in fact, it was more than implied in the original Fire and Fury that it besmirched her name, and she came out and she fought them on it. And I think good on her for doing it. I think more people need to actually push back.
Oh, no doubt about that. But it's a question of the little guy against the big guy. And on this occasion, it was a little guy against the big guy, except that they were irrefutable facts, which were not being admitted by Stuff until this woman, with her legal background, maybe made a comment or two about, what's the old expression, David? Lawyering up.
Yeah, and that's the problem, because lawyering up, particularly when it comes to reputational harm, can be very, very expensive indeed. Defamation and that type of thing are extremely difficult. But one way you can get around it is under the Harmful Digital Communications Act, if in fact you've been harmed by an incorrect an incorrect post online, and so much stuff is online these days, and of course stuff is online these days as well, that the Act is something that has to be considered as an alternative to the expensive course of defamation. Harmful digital communication may not provide you with damages, but it certainly provides a basis for requiring the person who's got it wrong to print a retraction and an apology and all sorts of, and furthermore, take the material down.
Hmm. And I understand that the editing has taken place of the video, so the extract is now no longer in there. So good on her. I actually think it's really important that people, as I said, to push back and sort of question these media outlets on some of these things. So, yeah, I'm pleased that, as you said, that there was a retraction there, but again, it was pretty scant. And I do note that they were still asking for donations at the bottom of the story. So good on them. So to continue on with our were they asking for forgiveness instead of permission theme, Jodie O'Donnell apologises to workers over the bungled cost-cutting moves in with the process in regards to taking people, reducing numbers at TVNZ. I can't quite decide whether this was a case of corporate ineptitude, or were they hoping to actually, or were they, did they build in that they were probably going to get pinged by the union on this and built this in as part of their plan because they didn't really want to spook the horses at the time? I mean, what are your thoughts on this, Peter? You've been in this environment.
Well, I've been in an employment situation with TVNZ, and my experience is that TVNZ's HR department, its management, shoots first and asks questions later. They don't look at contracts. I had a contract which at the time of my process, which was, I think, 2016, I had a contract which had not been updated since either the year 2000 or 2001. So it was a very old-fashioned contract. It was literally one page long. So there were lots of things on that which gave me quite a good number of rights. And TVNZ did not look at that. And as a consequence, we went through a process. We went through mediation. And I was, I guess, of a means to be able to employ a lawyer, and it's so old now that I don't think I'm giving away too many secrets. I won hundreds of thousands of dollars from TVNZ for it, and this happens all the time. You look at their annual reports about that time through the remuneration list that they're provided, that they're required to provide each annual report. And there were some years, and this is back 2013, 2014. Some years, even back then, they were paying out millions of dollars. And I, when I say millions, $2-4 million a year in redundancy payments. So restructuring and firing people and getting rid of people has been going on for years in that place. That's why I laugh when I read that line the other day of Jodie O'Donnell saying, we're transitioning to be a digital-first organization. For God's sake, they've been transitioning to a digital-first organization since the days of Rick Ellis as the chief executive. When was that? Back in the early 2000s. So their process goes on and on and on. But at the end of the day, they're a linear television broadcaster trying to make money through advertising. And that advertising market has fallen away big time. I don't think they can ever recover their previous financial status. And for them to be reporting a loss of $28 to $33 million mm-hmm. this year surely brings into question the whole viability, the whole existence of it as a government-owned television company in under its current structure. It's either got to be fully funded, fully owned, a la ABC, a la BBC, CBC, et cetera, or else it's just got to be sold off to the private sector. I mean, it cannot keep on going, being a company losing $30 million a year, because it ain't going to recover that money being a digital-first organisation in the world where they're up against Netflix and even locally up against Sky. I mean, I've got off the topic here, but in terms of their employment processes, what I read about them not reading the fine print is just entirely consistent with what I know through personal experience.
All right, so definitely smacks of same shit, different day.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. Like I say, it was going on before my issue, which is, gosh, nearly 8 years ago. It was going on well before that. And obviously, it's still going on now. Different chief executives, different management. It's just the corporate beast doesn't seem to know how to read contracts, which is a bit strange, to say the least. My other question is, where the hell was the TBNZ board on all this? Willie Jackson's mates appointed to the board who just don't appear to have had any oversight for it. Is the chief executive going to be docked part of her rather lucrative bonus for this, frankly, appalling lack of oversight? I mean, you lose at the ERA and then you lose in the employment court. Jeepers. And you hired a KC along the way. I mean, dear me, surely their in-house counsel must have known they got it wrong from the off.
Well, Willie Jackson's come out against the board.
I've seen that.
Media Insider this morning in the Herald, Shane Curry reports that Willie Jackson is very disenchanted with the people that he appointed to continue to fly the flag after Labor sank, rather like a Republican president appointing people to the United States Supreme Court so that his legacy can continue. Well, Willie is not too excited about the legacy anymore. It seems as though the board might have let him down, and he was complaining about Sunday going and staff going and all sorts of things. Where was the board? Well, Willie ain't too happy with them, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, but Willie Jackson's a bit like the tides. He changes his mood twice a day, and it's obviously the tides going out. But then, you know, who knows? I mean, TVNZ does completely tank. Maybe he'll get his blessed merger after all.
Well, apparently they're going to be moving into the... They want Radio New Zealand to move into the same building. So who knows?
I love this final statement from Jodie O'Donnell. And I mean, it always amazes me as an ex-copywriter how people can write stuff that says practically nothing. And this was one of those fabulous statements. As you're aware, TVNZ is in the early stages of a multi-year transformation. As you've been saying, Peter, it should be multi-decade transformation and further changes on our horizon. Change is essential if we're to secure a substantial future for this organisation. Crucial to the success of our transformation program is our ability to have a positive working relationship. We have an obligation to New Zealand audiences, our shareholder, our advertisers, and of course our people to move forward constructively and deliver on TVNZ's purpose and mandate. And that is what the executive team and I intend to do.
Good. I'm pleased.
I'm sure you've heard different variations of this tune over the years. Yeah, I can't see a lot more changing there other than the fact that advertisers will continue to walk away. I mean,
well, advertisers buy audience. They buy, as somebody once described to me, they buy the currency of television, which are the TARPs, the T-A-R-Ps, the target audience rating points. Now, if those rating points are dropping, then the advertisers are going to walk away. I do note that there appears to be a bit more paid advertising on TV One at the moment than has been the case in recent months. But from my occasional forays onto TV One, such as the Brokenwood Mysteries or Phil Spencer's, you know, top homes of New Zealand, because I, you know, I like to see what kind of places my friends are living in these days. I note that while TVNZ Plus is still the main advertiser, for want of a better word, there is more and more paid advertising from various corporates. So that's an encouraging sign. But then maybe it's at cut price. I don't know. But $28 to $33 million forecast loss suggests that there's not as much advertising as there used to be.
Well, I certainly can attest that I think it will be definitely a cut loss. I mean, having done a bit of TV advertising for the day job in recent years, now, to be fair, it has been with Warner Discovery, not with TVNZ, but I know that when I looked at rack rates versus promotional rates, even for a one-off advertiser like us, where we only do advertising maybe once or twice a year, I was stunned at the pricing. In fact, really, to be brutally honest with you, your cost of production is vastly higher. So that's obviously why you quite often see the quality of ads coming through, because you can actually get something on relatively cheap, and it's your production costs chew things up, not necessarily the cost of getting it to air. So how times have changed.
Indeed. Yep. The days of Saatchi and Saatchi are well and truly over, I would have thought.
Oh, I know. And just the creativity, you know, having come from that space originally into all of this. We'll talk about that with Omar's piece a little later on. The whole loss of creativity is actually, it's quite heartbreaking. But speaking of creativity or lack thereof, News Hub, TikTok, for them, the website, I think there's some hope that they were going to save the website. So as the new service disappeared, the website would remain. That has now been quashed. Everything's been moved across to Stuff. In April, they sort of said, yes, we were number three. They're in a tussle from what I can see between bouncing between third and fourth news website between themselves and RNZ. Stuff's number one at the top of the pops. NZ Herald just below it, which is interesting considering that more than half the content on the Herald website is subscriber only, premium only. Where do they go? I mean, all those teams wash out to in this time? Because Stuff have got their digital teams. They're just pulling everything over in an archive and keeping it running. There's a lot of people that are going to be floating around and looking for jobs. Yeah.
David?
Any thoughts on that?
I was a little bit concerned when I saw that the News Hub website was closing and it was going to migrate across to Stuff because, frankly, I think that Stuff's website is abysmal. I can remember many years ago when I was teaching law and IT, one of the things that we were looking at was a website design for getting legal information across. So legal information websites were something of an interest area for me and something of a teaching area as well. But that sort of morphed into a larger interest in website design. Now, from my point of view, I think that Stuff is just dreadful. I think that Herald isn't much better. And one of the problems that they've got, I think, and it must be with their algorithms, is that they obviously rank their stories by reader interest. But so many times you actually see the same story appearing maybe three or four times down the list of stories. And from the point of view of actually trying to find the information that you want, it is not easy. If you are talking about a news / information source, there needs to be a lot more design work done to improve that. I'm surprised that the Herald website gets the Voyager Award, but we spoke about awards last time we were together. But they seem to manage to have got an award for something that I think justifies it. In fact, it's somewhat difficult to find a decent news website, unless, of course, you want to go to the New York Times, which I think is fabulous.
I quite enjoyed the Daily Telegraph out of London, David. That's my personal favourite.
I'll have to have a look at that.
And they have some great stuff. But talking of news websites, I think this one has rather slipped under the radar. In fact, it hasn't been reported anywhere, as far as I know. The only reason I know about it is because I was a subscriber, and that's the demise of the very short-lived ZB Plus. Are you aware of this, Marie? I paid up last year because I was very enthusiastic about ZB Plus, particularly with Thomas Cranmer, Philip Crump as its editor-in-chief. He was hired, and there was a bit of a song and dance about that, and I think that was only about October or November of last year. Well, blow me down, I get a note from ZB Plus. I signed up, and I don't know what it cost me, maybe a couple of $100 or something like that. I got a note from ZB Plus the other day to say that it's being closed down and is being essentially folded into Business Desk, which was a business news website started by the late Brian Gaynor, acquired by NZME. Now, ZB Plus is being folded into Business Desk. I got a refund of $35, which remarkably they couldn't pay me because my credit card number has changed in the last year. But I have put that $35 to a very cheap new subscription for the Herald, which I did not renew when the time came because, as I say, my credit card number had changed and they couldn't renew it automatically. So I've now signed up again to the Herald, I think, for, I don't know, $99 for the year, $35 of which is a refund from ZB Plus. But yeah, that was a very short-lived experiment. I think it was about Shane Curry trying to get Thomas Cranmer, a bit of a Freudian slip there, trying to get Thomas Cranmer off the internet because he was just showing up journalists because he was so blinking good. He was getting so many good stories. He seemed to get swallowed up in the NZME corporate behemoth and didn't really make much of an impression there. I see he's been working furiously on X or Twitter lately, once again exposing some great stories. Pity he hasn't gone to Substack. He seems to go in the OIA space, get some great scoops. I suspect he's left ZB Plus. That arrangement is all over. No public announcement's been made. But yeah, that was something that has just really slipped under the under the radar. No more ZB Plus, and frankly, it never made much of an impact anyway.
Cranmer still does have a Substack, but he doesn't post anything to it. He hasn't posted.
Yeah, I know, that's annoying. Yeah.
Well, and that's a shame because I think the Twitter work is good, but trying to sort of get any sense out of the material that he puts up at Twitter with the way in which they render the material is a little bit difficult. Mm. Cranmer / Phil Crump is, you know, a superb analyst, absolute dynamite, and I hope he continues. But it would be nice to see him back on Substack. Like you, Peter, I wondered what had happened to him with the demise of ZB Plus. I too was a subscriber, and I too got the refund. But I got the distinct feeling that Thomas Cranmer was heading off in another direction.
Yeah, yeah, I wondered whether something was up because he has increased his X content quite markedly, and he was dropping some really big stuff. And I thought, this is interesting. Why is this dropping here and not dropping under ZB Plus? And I had heard that they'd been struggling. Interesting your view, Peter, that they'd sort of pulled him into that fold to quieten him down. All I have to say is realitycheck.radio/joinus. Okay, Phil, if you're listening.
Yeah. Oh no, he's a man who's had a bit of connection with us over time. So he'd be most welcome on this outlet, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely, and also too the I know he is covering and he has been covering even prior to heading into ZB Plus the Waipareta Trust, the Manurewa Marae, and all of that. He has got his finger absolutely on the pulse of that. I am waiting to see what he comes up with because he does the work and he puts it in there, and I love seeing what he pops out onto X because he just sort of drops the information out there. No, it just here it is, and it's like, oh, okay,
it's really, in many respects, it's great journalism because he's saying, here is the information. I'm not offering any comment. Here is the evidence. This is the way it is. You make up your own mind, and I just think, in some respects, that's a great way to be a journalist. It was the same with his Substacks, particularly his expose of the financial arrangements around the Three Waters, the proposed Three Waters planning, because he was a lawyer in London who had great experience of leveraged buyouts and he knew how blinking dodgy they were. So he was putting the evidence out there to say, this is just a crock, what is being planned. And we all knew that. Now, those plans are all gone, thank goodness. But he was the one who explained it to us in pretty much layman's language, and I think we should thank him for that.
Oh, no, I think it's very much a watch this space for
The other thing that he has exposed, Marie, and this is something that I haven't seen reported anywhere else, this is this public service-led inquiry into Waipareta Trust and the National Urban Māori Authority and the Manurewa Marae, et cetera, et cetera. The inquiry into John Tamahere's wheelings and dealings. We know last Friday that Michael Herron, KC, was announced as the head of the inquiry, and that was that. I thought, well, yeah, Michael Herron, good for him. He's going to be leading it, a man who's got a high profile in the legal profession. So he's going to be taking this inquiry. What we did not hear at the time, and it was Cranmer slash Philip Crump who told me this, was that Heron is going to have an offsider by the name of Pania Gray, who has quite deep tentacles inside Māoridom. So straight away, the whole whiff of a whitewash is there for all to smell.
Well, I think it might be a brown wash in this case, Peter, but let's...
Yeah. Yeah. So what I'm saying is that Heron by himself, it would have been great with a secretariat to have another inquirer with him who has done work, quite a lot of work in Māoridom and has Māori sympathies, suggests to me that this ain't going to tell us too much. And that's deeply bothering inside a democracy where there are literally millions and millions and millions of taxpayer dollars involved.
Oh, is he what? I'm just really wanting to wait and see on this. I mean, I know we're getting off topic and I'm going to pull us back in a second, but the fact that there are so many whistleblowers that have come out, that hasn't happened in the past. So this is, and they seem to have gone through a very, very careful process. He has slithered around the corridors of New Zealand Parliament and figured out how to maximise returns and turn Māori into a commodity, basically.
This is Tamahere talking.
Tamahere, and he has done it very, very successfully. So I'll be very intrigued to see. However, I would like to see your thoughts, particularly, David, which you put out on Monday in your Substack. And unlike Mr. Crump, you do publish to your Substack regularly, and I love it, as you put out a piece on Monday called What Should the Government Do About Media? And a lot of that was a transcript, speaking of putting things in simple language, from Andrew Ferguson-Neal, British journalism, the chair of The Spectator, fabulous guy. When this video dropped, I cheered, I loved it. So, David, what the government should do about media?
Well, yeah, this was one of those sort of serendipitous accidents which you just happen to pick up as you're trolling around. And I came across the information on the very brief clip that I put on the Substack, where Neil was answering a question that was put to him by one of the members of the House of Lords Communications and Digital Committee back in April. And I thought, well, this is interesting. I'd like to know more. Fortunately, rather like our Parliament, there are a number of transcripts and so on and so forth of the various committees. It's a question of working out how to get them. But once the information is there, it can be very, very revealing. And in fact, the transcript says more about what Mr. Neal's view of government involvement in the media was about than the little one-minute clip on YouTube put out. I mean, Baroness Harding was the lady who asked the question as to what Mr. Neal thought of how interventionist the government should be in supporting the news sector, if at all, and what do you think would constitute government overreach. Neal came through and said, you should stay the hell out of it, which I think is probably something that Mr. Goldsmith might take heed of. Neil went on to say, you don't know anything about it, which of course is perfectly correct. You are only trouble. We are not on your side, he said, of the media. You are not on our side. We are different. Relations between journalists, media, and government should always be bad and never on any account should be allowed to get better, which is wonderful stuff to hear. I do not want any of your help. Wouldn't that be lovely to hear Sinead Bishop say that? From stuff. I do not want any of your help. That would be a surprise. Then he went on to say how he'd rebuilt the Spectator without help from anyone. No government help, no tax incentives, no intervention. And then he went on to comment about the government. You cannot even keep the streets safe at night, which sort of sounds a little bit familiar. The Scottish government cannot build two bog standard ferries. That also sounds very familiar. This Parliament cannot build a single high-speed line, so stay out of news. You're just trouble. We do not want any help. I just do not want you to interfere. I do not want your tax subsidies. I do not want your help. I want to just concentrate. I'm a Jeffersonian. The government should concentrate on doing what only government can do and do it well. What a wonderful, wonderful commentary. I mean, that is just absolutely first rate. And it gets better because he makes comments about local news and the fact that local news is primarily supported by advertising from local government and whether or not the big tech firms should have too much influence. And he says, yes, they do, but that boat has sailed. It's too late to do anything about that. So maybe we should start thinking about the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill in that particular context. And then he talked about the general effect of Facebook and technology on news consumption. And it is a wonderful commentary, a realistic commentary on the problems that media has and what the government cannot and should not do about it. And my view has been for a long time that the government should stay right out of it. And of course, every time I say something like that, people think, oh, what about Radio New Zealand? And I say, yeah, what about Radio New Zealand? Get rid of it, along with Television New Zealand. Sell both of them. Let private enterprise deal with it. That's where it belongs. Unless, of course, you're going to have a proper state broadcasting, as you said earlier on, Peter, like the ABC or the BBC. But right now, we seem to be in a real mixture. And, of course, the government is, the media are coming along with their hands out. What the government should do about the media is say, solve your own problems, don't look to us. But then in our country, the government's always the first port of call.
Yes. There's an interesting piece in the Media Insider in the Herald this morning with a couple of very small ways the government could possibly help TVNZ, you know, close the gap from their $28 to $33 million loss. One is to allow advertising on Sunday mornings. Now, Sunday morning advertising has always, for some reason, been a no-no, and I don't know why. I mean, when I started in the game 50-odd years ago, there was no advertising on Sunday, full stop, on either radio or television. And that was, for some reason, just the way it was. Then it was allowed Sunday afternoon on TV, but not on Sunday morning. So when you've got programs such as Q&A, which have, you know, the chattering classes watching them, they are, you know, affluent people, a bit of well-placed advertising targeted to them might be a good idea. It might make a few million over the course of a year for TVNZ. The other thing is to, or the other thing that has been suggested, is that the transmission fees, the costs that, or the prices that TVNZ and indeed every broadcaster, commercial broadcaster in the country pays to maintain frequencies up and down the country, they could be dropped. Those prices could be dropped to allow a bit of relief as well. So that to me is about as far as the government should go in interfering in the broadcasting and media market. Let the market decide what is good will survive, what is bad will fail, and that frankly is the way it should always be.
And it's interesting you mentioned the BBC, David, because the one thing I would say here is the ideological captor in the BBC now is almost so complete that you know they are in a death spiral of their own self-induced importance and purity. So,
yeah. Well, of course, Neil makes the comment that if the government has any sort of role, it is just to make sure the playing field is a level one. And after that, it's up to the organisations and to the market to do what they can. But it was an interesting article, and I'm glad that I sort of took the time to drill down and find the transcript, because the transcript actually was more interesting in its fullest sense than a 1 minute long YouTube clip.
The YouTube intriguing that he talks about having turned the Spectator around. I don't know what the financial state of the Spectator was before he became the chairman. To my understanding, the Spectator as a magazine has been very much part of the British media scene since the 19th century. So it's a very long-standing publication. Boris Johnson, for a time, was the editor of it. I think in those days it was called the Sextator because he was having yet another affair with somebody who was on the staff. But the fact that the Spectator can have an addition, I think, in Britain, in the US, and Australia, possibly even in Canada as well. It's essentially a subscription-based model because there's virtually no advertising on it. It's a subscription-based model and essentially online. And I subscribe to it, and I really enjoy it. But there's a real there's a really big number of contributors, all of whom are just great writers. So I thoroughly enjoy The Spectator, and I think it's a case of if you hit the spot with your intended audience, it's not necessarily completely wide ranging. It is still, I suppose, somewhat niche, but it's quality writing, and people are prepared to pay for quality writing, quality opinion, well-reasoned opinion, and every now and then, quite a few facts that you don't read anywhere else. So I'll maintain my subscription to The Spectator. I think it's about $17 a month, and I, as far as I'm concerned, it's money well spent.
Well, it's one of the few that I actually subscribe to as well. It's excellent. So Paul Goldsmith then. I mean, Melissa Lee, I actually felt that she got a raw deal. She was doing what I think, even though she was a sort of a new minister, she was pretty hands-off, and she should have been. And I feel that she was a victim of media pressure and optics. So what should Paul Goldsmith do?
Well, yeah, I sort of thought about this and put out a post this morning about Paul Goldsmith and his vacillating and ambivalent position as far as the media is concerned. Because he was before the Social Services and Community Select Committee earlier this week and was asked and tried to answer questions about what was happening. Ricardo Menendez March, who I understand is a Green MP, asked if the government was taking a hands-off approach to media woes. And Goldsmith went on to say that they'd put $100 million into New Zealand on air and $70 million for Radio New Zealand and so on and so forth. Whereas the answer that I would have given if I was Goldsmith was, yes, we are taking a hands-off approach to the media, which would be quite in line with Andrew Neil's comments as well. But what he didn't do was kick to the curb the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, which is just yet another form of subsidy for the media, rather like the Public Interest Journalism Fund. And my feeling about it is that he is unlikely to kick the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill to the curb because he actually had some sympathy with aspects of the Public Interest Journalism Fund. He was cherry-picking, in a way, by saying that he thought that the reporting that PIJF had done or had funded on court reporting and on local government reporting was a good thing. But the fact of the matter is that it was a subsidy. And it continues to be a subsidy because if you have a look at some of the stories that are put out, particularly in the print media, there's the little thing, funding provided by New Zealand On Air via the Public Interest Journalism Fund. So it's still around. And the fact of the matter is that it's likely to continue in some shape or form, be it the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill or the PIJF or some kind of hybrid. Because what it does is that the government isn't going to give media money without tagging it, without having some conditions. That was the problem with the PIJF. But I would be willing to bet that there will be some kind of subsidisation of media provided by the government, directly or indirectly, that will be tagged. Because in that way, the government can exercise some control over the messaging, which, of course, as far as Andrew Neil is concerned, is an absolute anathema. We are not your friends, he said, and long may that continue.
Well, the only politician that actually seems to live within that realm is Winston Peters. I mean, he is not a friend of the media, and the media is not a friend of his. And it's, I almost feel like that threat that he had, I can't remember who he said it to, but he said, if I became the Minister of Broadcasting, wouldn't that have been a fine thing?
Yes, but remember, New Zealand First is not beyond feathering their mates' pockets as well. I mean, yesterday,
as we've just seen in a,
there was Shane Jones handing out
$30 million or something.
Yeah, the heading of a provincial growth fund or whatever its 2024 equivalent is. So like the old saying goes, you can't trust any of the bastards, really. I'm with David here. Just let the market decide who is who, and who can make a crust, and let them all decide. The other thing that I think is going to continue, because there's been no sign of it shutting down, are these other two government funded projects through New Zealand On Air. One is called, what is it, Local Democracy Project or Local Democracy Reporting, and the other one is Open Justice. So in other words, the government is paying cadet reporters to go and sit in district courtrooms and at council meetings. And frankly, in days gone by, that was always the job of a mid-level reporter. There were specialist court reporters even in the provincial papers. Obviously, they cannot be afforded anymore. There were specialist council reporters, you know, mid-grade guys of, you know, 10, 15 years experience, people in their 30s and 40s who would go and sit at boring old council meetings and report on the minutiae of council business. That doesn't seem to happen much apart from at the Otago Daily Times anymore. But there is going to be, I presume, a continuation of government funding for Open Justice and for Local Democracy. And I just find that a bit sad too, because as David says, it's going to come with the inevitable tags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will. In terms of money being spent in places and not getting returns, I just want to actually sort of pivot a little bit to a story that I've been following with Marty over on Media Matters, with Stephen Omar, who is a writer and was involved in a number of media companies. And he came out a few weeks ago with Shane Curry with a piece around his frustration, primarily around the New Zealand Film Commission. And the reason he spoke up is he's been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I just find, firstly, it exceptionally sad that it's taken that diagnosis for him to actually finally speak up, that the fact that someone in the media, in an environment, couldn't speak truthfully, plainly, and frankly, unless you had absolutely nothing to lose. So I thought that in itself is a sad indictment on the industry as a whole. And Shane Curry, bless him, followed up on that sort of initial lunch meeting that he had with him. And there's some eye-watering numbers. And John Barnett, who is known for Whale Rider and Sione's Wedding, is obviously a friend and compatriot of Omar's. And he created a spreadsheet, because they're quite critical of the New Zealand Film Commission. Omar called them conservative in losing their creativity. In the spreadsheet, Barnett had a look at 54 films that received funding in 2020, and it was to a total of $88 million, which included around $51-odd million in direct funding, $37-odd million in rebates. The turnover, the revenue generated by those 54 films and $88 million put in, was only $14 million. And New Zealand has not seen a successful, positive box office success funded by the New Zealand Film Commission since Hunt for the Wilder People. That's a lot of money supposedly supporting our creative arts. When we're obviously not getting the return on investment, so where to from here? I mean, have you guys got any thoughts around that in terms of that funding? And it's not, I know one of the things Omar has sort of toyed with is combining New Zealand On Air with the New Zealand Film Commission, but it certainly has it's ruffled a few feathers amongst those within the commission in Wellington, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think the main problem here is the type of stories that are being told. Is that this is the New Zealand Film Commission that has put up, what is it, $3.2 million for a movie about Jacinda Ardern? Or was it $800,000 out of the
$800,000, I think, yeah.
And New Zealand On Air just does not make any stories that might be what you would say are coming from a right-wing perspective. We've got, one hates to use the old phrase, but a bunch of woke lovies running the Film Commission and New Zealand On Air, and it's only projects that they seem to like, that have their view of the world, that get approval. So I think it's pretty straightforward that there's a lot of bad decisions made, some very bad stories being told. Intriguing that you talk about the hunt for the Wilder people. I noticed that, I think it's this weekend, Marie Sky, I saw a promo the other night, Sky Movies are showing a thing called Uproar, which I'd never heard of until I saw it. But it features Gillian Dennison, who, of course, was the star of Hunt for the Wilder People. And this is a movie shot in Dunedin last year. It has over $1 million in grants and subsidies from the Film Commission. Its take, even though it's been critically acclaimed, its box office take, $750,000. So that's yet another loss-making operation, although according to John Barnett's figures, it sounds like it's one of the more successful Film Commission investments of recent times. But the common thread is that it's Gillian Dennison, who is frankly box office in this country. And, you know, he's a very talented young guy. So good for him, but I'd never heard of Uproar, but that's just another example of another loss-making project. And I imagine that there are too many of them, way too many of them. Perhaps the people making the decisions at both the Film Commission and at New Zealand On Air should look at the breadth of the stories being told and the aspects of society which are being covered in their stories. Then they might get a better return on investment.
David, do you think it's a case of the Film Commission, have actually lost sight of who New Zealand audiences actually are and what it is that they're wanting to see?
Well, I always thought that New Zealand On Air and the Film Commission was set up to provide some sort of support or subsidy. And I hate that word and I hate the concept of a subsidy. But a subsidy to develop a New Zealand identity in the arts. And, if you're going to have a subsidy, that's probably a pretty good objective. The only difficulty is that the arts is a very, very broad church. And as Peter has said, the decision-making about what gets funded and what doesn't get funded is questionable. The problem is, of course, that we have an awful lot of talent in particularly the movie industry, the film industry. Huge amount of talent. My understanding is that Weta Digital is flooded with work, primarily from overseas filmmakers for their special effects and so on and so forth. And, of course, Jackson is looking at another part of the Lord of the Rings franchise. I bet he's not getting any funding from the Film Commission for that. But I imagine that there'll be tax subsidies and so on and so forth. But in many respects, I suppose what you're looking at is funding for niche projects. Now, if they were to be honest and say, we are funding projects that perhaps aren't going to be commercially successful, people might say, well, that's okay, and maybe more people would be prepared to get in behind and go along and occupy a theatre seat for that purpose, because it is a niche thing. And there's been a confession that it isn't going to make a profit. So it's up to the audience as to whether or not they're prepared to get in behind it. But the fact of the matter is, if you're going to put out crap product, you're not going to get an audience. And so much of the material that is coming out is just so niche that it's got very little attraction at all.
Yeah, well, that comes down to that whole sort of cultural filler diversity sort of gaps. And Omar talked about this here. He said, Omar is also puzzled about falling television viewership behind the well-versed trend away from linear viewing. He believes there's more to it. One of the big problems, he says, is the quality of commissioning. Another is the lack of creativity in what networks are asking for or being presented by producers. Some projects, he says, have been funded simply because they tick a politically correct or cultural box. And I think that speaks to your point quite well, David. It's doing a box-ticking exercise when I know one of the arguments he's talked about is a merger between small and large screen. So New Zealand On Air with the New Zealand Film Commission, because ultimately at the end of the day, you want to get in front of eyeballs, and if whether or not it's in a small screen or a big screen, really should that matter? And you need to look at, I look at some of the more successful projects that have been operating in recent years, and actually the Brokenwood Mysteries, Peter, you mentioned that before. I mean, that's been going now, what, 6, 7 years?
Is it 10? All over the world. Started on Prime, for goodness sake. So
I know.
The TVNZ commissioners were so snobbish that they said, oh, this is just rubbish. We don't think this is worthwhile. So just go and put it on that funny little channel called Prime that nobody watches, and then blow me down. It's now 8:30 Sunday night, prime time.
Yeah.
And probably one of TV1's best performers.
Well, we're watching a program on Prime Video at the moment. It's a six-part dramatization of a book called The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart. It's an Australian book and an Australian production, although they've pulled in Sigourney Weaver in the lead role, and one that doesn't do her appearance any favours at all, because she's portrayed as a tough country woman. It is an absolutely beautiful production in all aspects. I mean, I love photography, so when I see a well-photographed piece of work, you know, I adore it. The lighting is magnificent. The way in which they've used the music, the script is economical. The acting is superb. The story is very, very strong and quite a mystery to it as well, so it holds attention. It's a beautiful production, and yet it's all about domestic violence.
Yeah, I think that's the thing with these shows, is that if you are able to produce something that then can get wide distribution. I've got friends in the States who've watched The Brokenwood Mysteries and said, oh, I've just found this New Zealand production, I absolutely love it. And it comes down to character storytelling and a little bit of escapism. And, you know, viewers have gotten to a point now where they're just sick and tired of being preached to by an ideological class. And yep. So much, even in the United States now, a lot of them are struggling in those main network shows, because a lot of very, very popular shows, the writers have gotten in there, they've added a lot of ideological and critical theory-based content, and viewers are just walking away. They're like, no, we plug in. If we're going to take some time to plug into a show, whether it be in television or a movie, we're not doing it to be told what to do and how to think and how to act. We're doing it because we want 40 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes of escapism. And I wonder whether they've forgotten that, those that produce these shows.
I wonder, Marie and David, whether or not in 2024, Once Were Warriors would be made. Because that was a book which was brutal when Alan Duff first published it in the 1980s. When was that film made? I think is it 30 years ago now? That lifted the scab on domestic violence and on the Maori underclass in this country. Not a lot has changed, of course, but would the commissars at the Film Commission or New Zealand On Air, would they allow that scab to be lifted in 2024? I doubt it.
No, I think it's an
unfavourable portrayal.
Yeah.
Of a group of society, most unfavourable portrayal. No, we can't.
Yeah. I think it's its 30-year anniversary this year, and I heard Temuera Morrison just interviewed yesterday, and I showed that film. It's funny, I showed that film almost exactly this time last year to our two teenage sons. And I said to them, I think you guys need to see this. And when I saw it, I found it really difficult to watch first time around. I grew up on the East Coast. So for me, there was, I'd seen things like that. You know, that was part of how part of the culture was growing up in that part of New Zealand. And I thought, how have it aged in this time? That film is just as relevant today as it was when it hit our screens 30 years ago. And that shows you it's a testament. And that was filmed start to finish in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
6 weeks.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Quality is quality, isn't it? Well, gentlemen, time is flowing by, as it does every time we do the show. Thank you so much this morning for your input. Any final thoughts, David, Peter, before we head off?
No, I'm currently engaged in a project looking at a paper by Dr. Gavin Ellis about media regulation and so on. That's going out on my Substack, which is occupying a bit of my time and mind. So watch that space.
So that's the Halfling's View, of course, on Substack. And I know, Peter, you're putting it a bit on Substack as well.
Oh, yes, I run hot and cold on it. And
so whoever's exercising you at the time. And
yeah, I know. I'm really desperate to go off the long run against council rates, because I have an absolute bee in my bonnet about these outrageous increases in council rates. Ours here in Central Otago were announced as going up 18% the other day. And all the mayor has said two things. One, he said, well, if you can't afford them, take out a reverse mortgage on your property to pay for it. And the other one is, well, you should be thankful it's 18, because we were originally looking at 44%. And I'm thinking, my God, you have no idea. I live down a dirt road. I don't have any sewerage. I think I've told you this before. I don't have my rubbish collected. The council provides me with no water services. I get nothing from the rates apart from membership at the Cromwell Library if I want it. And I'm being charged another 18% for getting no services. So I feel a Substack rant coming on in that respect.
And I can assure the listener,
declare yourself an independent republic, Peter.
And I can assure our listeners that no local journalism funding has been received by Peter for his rant.
No.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. As always, this has been the Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio. Don't disappear, because up next is Dewa De Boer with the dialogue here on RCR. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Fourth Estate right here on RCR. Reality Check Radio. Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.